Harlan Ellison may need no introduction, but giving him a really, really long one is irresistible to me. He is an amazing figure. As a writer of fantasy and horror and speculative fiction over the last 50 years, he's published many hundreds of short stories. The most famous of them, and among the best-known short stories by anyone in the last half century, are I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream and A Boy and His Dog. In his long career, he's also written novels and movies, and he worked on practically every TV show I watched as a child growing up. Route 66, Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, Alfred Hitchcock, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., the original Star Trek, The Outer Limits. And it was a couple of Ellison's Outer Limits episodes that inspired James Cameron to write the Terminator movies. His life has been like something out of a movie. The one picked-on Jewish kid in an Ohio small town who left home and made it big. Became a celebrity and a notorious playboy, marched with Martin Luther King from Selma to Montgomery in 1965, pursued countless feuds and lawsuits, including an important case against AOL about online copyright protection, It sounds like something out of a film, and now is, because Harlan Ellison is the subject of a new documentary called Dreams with Sharp Teeth. Harlan Ellison, welcome to Studio 360.
I'm quietly humble and proud to be here. You forgot to mention I'm a snappy dresser and a good dancer.
Well, I tried to stick with the objective descriptions, but happy birthday as well.
Thank you. Yes, it's impossible for me to understand, but come the 27th of May, I will be 74 years old. I'm 14 years older than the state of Israel.
Well, there you go.
It's very daunting, daunting.
Even older than John McCain.
Well, yes, I am older than John McCain, poor old dear.
So I tried to avoid calling you a science fiction writer.
But which you just did on purpose.
No, I'm referring to what I didn't do.
Look, can I give you the scoop, Toots?
Please, honey.
Okay. For years and years, I have been writing what is best represented as the work by Edgar Allan Poe, Franz Kafka, or the South American writer Jorge Luis Borges.
Yeah.
What I write is a kind of twisted, I guess, fantasy. I have never written science fiction. I've occasionally used some of the furniture from that genre, but it's like calling Agatha Christie a railroad writer because she wrote Murder on the Calais Coach.
Yeah.
And I cannot get the words science fiction off me.
Yeah.
It's like you molest one person, all of a sudden you're a child molester. Do you understand?
I do. Well, and, you know, fantasy doesn't really do it either because that suggests dragons and
It didn't used to.
Yeah.
Fantasy used to be James Branch Cabell and Poe and Ambrose Bierce. It used to be a lofty and much lauded genre. It is, in fact, the oldest kind of writing we know, because the first writing we have is the Mesopotamian legend of Gilgamesh, and it's a fantasy, clearly.
Yeah.
But nowadays, the term, like most terms in our benighted world, has been turned and altered so that it no longer means what it meant. But people say, what do you write? And I say, Ellison stories.
Uh-huh. And you mention Poe, looking at your output over this last half century, there's something 19th century about it, in terms of its incredible size. How many pieces of fiction have you published?
Well, I sold my first piece to Weird Science Fantasy Comics to Bill Gaines when I was still in high school, and I guess I was about 16, and I've been writing ever since. I guess it's over 60 years now. And the short stories and essays and nonfiction pieces, it's 73 books, 1,700 stories, about two dozen movies, and God knows how many TV episodes I've written, just a lot of them.
Why so much?
Well, because I'm a writer, kid. That's what I do. You know, if I were a plumber and you said, how many toilets have you fixed? And I said, 10,000. You wouldn't say, boy, what a prolific plumber. What the hell else am I supposed to do?
Well, but no. If you plot every writer, and how many words of fiction they've produced, you would be well at the top. So I'm just wonder why you are, if not Maybe Joyce Carol Oates has produced more words than you, but I don't think so.
Well, look, in the days when I started writing, they were paying a penny a word.
Really?
A penny a word.
Wow.
It's as if I'm talking about the Neolithic people like
it's
you.
True.
I mean, you're a nice man. But yeah, that's what you got paid for writing a short story. Many magazines paid a half a cent a word on publication, which was 6 months later, or when you caught them and dragged them to boot. I wrote for a penny a word when I got booted out of Ohio State University. I had been on the road since I was 13, and I went to New York, and I had many, many, many jobs. I painted the Brooklyn Bridge with rust-resistant paint hanging upside down in a leather cradle going from one end to the other because the spume from the river made it rust so fast. That was one of the good jobs. I was a gypsy taxi hack driver. I did all manner of things. And in my spare time, I would write when I wasn't trying to keep food on the table. And I wrote all night long. And then I would take the story down to the magazine's office and try and sell it for a penny a word. And then I would go to work. And that was 24/7. And in those days, and we're talking 1955, 56, 57, if I can just make 10 grand a year, I'll be deliriously happy for the rest of my life. Because my father had not made $10,000 in 25 years of his life. In those days, money was less, but it went further.
Now you
loaf of bread was 13 cents.
You talk about painting the Brooklyn Bridge and all these colorful things you did. I read in various biographical sketches of you so many things that sound, some of which sound hard to believe. So when you ran away from home, when you left home at 13, did you actually join the carnival?
Absolutely. You know, things sound improbable from a distance. When you get close to them, you find that Einstein said things should be made as simple as possible, but no simpler. When I was a kid, there was no such thing as running away and joining a rock band. All there was the acoustic guitar. And if you wanted to join a band, you had to go and find Glenn Miller. But as a kid, I had read a book called Toby Tyler, or 10 Weeks with the Circus. And in my time, kids ran away and they joined the circus. It was a standard cliche.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Well, I ran away and tried to join a circus, but I couldn't find one, but there was a carnival. So I joined the carny, and I traveled with them for about 6 weeks until we got busted and all wound up in jail in Kansas City. And my mother and father, who, of course, were frantic, they were lovely, lovely people, they were frantic. They hired the Pinkerton Detective Agency to find me. And Pinkerton sent out what they called a Dodger, and a Dodger was a handbill. Have you seen this child in my picture there? And they posted it in every jail and post office in America, practically. And here I was standing in the lockup in KC, the rest of the carny having been sprung, except for me and the geek. And a turnkey came around and saw me and thought it matched the picture, and he went back and told the desk sergeant. Desk sergeant came in, took a look at me, called Cleveland, and Cleveland sent out a Pinkerton agent on the train, and he came and picked me up and took me home.
I mean, just all of those things, like joining the Carvey, the lockup, the Pinkerton guard, it does sound like, if not the Neolithic, an entirely other era.
Oh, it was. It was a completely different era. I was talking early this morning to a marvelous, he's a comic book artist, fine artist, named Gene Colan, who has drawn Batman and Daredevil and all manner of other things. And Gene and I were reminiscing about being younger. And Gene, when I work, I listen to music. I crank up, I got the best sound system in the world. I got quad electrostatic screens. And I was talking about listening to Morricone when I work. And Gene says, I'm not much on music or reading, because he's an artist. He says, I like sound effects. And he was talking about trains. He's got all of these LPs of trains, big freight trains, pulling in and out of the yards. And I said, oh, my God, the sound of a freight train pulling out is one of the most heavenly sounds in the world.
Yeah.
Because I used to ride the rails, and I was the last of the generation of kids who did ride the rails. And I hung out with hobos in hobo jungles. And it was a grand and glorious time. And I wouldn't recommend it to anyone today, because people are a lot meaner today than they were when I was a kid. But I went through adventures one after another, just like a kid in a Horatio Alger story, and nothing bad ever happened to me. I was hungry, and I got wet, and it was lonely and miserable. But looking back, It was a glorious, adventure-filled time, and it enriched my youth. It also made me tough enough so that when I got to college, however briefly I was there, and they tried to bully me, I would just punch a guy in a kisser and, you know, or hit him over the head with a brick, and it was terrific.
How come you've never assembled all of those extraordinary stranger-than-fiction stories into a massive autobiography?
Well, I'll tell you, the answer is it's an idiosyncratic answer, because you are not by any means even near close to the first person who has asked me that question. And it's the same as with the film Dreams with Sharp Teeth. When I go to a screening of it, and I've seen it now in public about four or five times in different venues and film festivals, and invariably they say to me, how do you feel about having a movie made about you? And I'm bereft of the proper verbiage. I just don't know what to say. I'm not being falsely humble, because God knows I've been working on humility for 74 years and haven't gotten it down yet. But it is a genuinely perplexing conundrum for me. It's as if I were one of the survivors of that oceanic flight that winds up on the Lost Island. And I'm sitting on the shore watching the tide going in and out without realizing that an entire continent has built up behind me. I don't know what to think about it. Great people who have had biographies written about them, everyone from Eleanor Roosevelt to Sojourner Truth to Lou Gehrig, I can see that. They are noble figures. I'm a professional liar. I tell funny stories for a living, and I've been blessed. As an atheist, that kind of word comes hard to my mouth, but I have been rewarded of living my own life and being utterly responsible for it, so I have no excuses, no one to blame anything on, and I've had some of the most amazing, amazing adventures with some of the most famous people who have lived during my time, and I was too busy living my life. Wait a minute, I'm about to clear my throat. Close off your speaker. I've been too busy living my life and observing other people's for stories to think that anybody really wanted to hear what I had to say. Not to mention that what you said earlier is such a terrible risk. When I start laying out the anecdotes at dinner or something, people invariably look at me askance as if I'm making this crap up as
right.
I go along.
Right.
And while I do embellish, as all good storytellers yeah. do from Chaucer on, I never deviate from the actual truth. And when I talk about, for instance, I'll give you, you want a for instance?
Sure.
Okay. A guy sued me for verbal assault and battery.
Right, right.
I had insulted him.
In an interview.
We go to small claims court, and he says, he's suing me, and he can't, and I said, Your Honor, he says, I cannot repeat the words. I just can't repeat the words. They're too awful. They're too awful. So the judge looks at me, and he said, what exactly did you call him, Mr. Ellison? And I said, I called him a pus-sucking diphthong. And the judge said, what? And I repeated, I said, pus-sucking diphthong. And he said, what does that mean? I said, well, Your Honor, do you find pus-sucking obscene and, you know, the dirty language? He said, no. I said, what about diphthong? He said, was that the figure of speech? I said, yes, a diphthong. He said, no. And he looked at the guy and he said, case dismissed. Well, only an imbecile or somebody who gets a great deal of laughter out of life, such as myself and Kurt Vonnegut and Arthur in the movie with Dudley Moore, people like us, we just find a lot of crap funny. And we do a lot of strange crap because it seems funny. My friend Patton Oswalt, the comedian, he says, you know, the problem with you is that you think everybody is in on the gag. So I'll say all manner of things that if you were watching a Woody Allen movie, you would think were very funny. The problem is my life is not like a Woody Allen movie. There's no one following me along taking notes.
Among all the stories you've written, do you have favorites or is...
Well, everybody, I don't know why everybody thinks you would have a favorite. I mean, out of 1,700 stories, there are ones that I like particularly because they make me feel good or because I knew what I was doing and I was at the top of my game.
Well that's why you'd have favorites, those.
Well, one of my very, very favorites is called Paladin of the Lost Hour, which they made we made into a Twilight Zone episode. It was the last performance of Danny Kaye. And if you like, I could read you a few paragraphs of it.
Sure.
Would you like to hear that?
Absolutely.
Okay.
This is which Twilight Zone? The original Twilight Zone?
No. This is the one I worked on in 1985.
In the 80s. Right.
This is the beginning of Paladin of the Lost Hour. This was an old man, not an incredibly old man, obsolete, spavined, not as worn as the swayback stone steps ascending the Pyramid of the Sun to an ancient temple, not yet a relic, but even so, a very old man. This old man perched on an antique shooting stick, its handles open to form a seat, its spike thrust at an angle into the soft ground and trimmed grass of the cemetery. Gray, thin rain misted down at almost the same angle as that at which the spike pierced the ground. The winter-barren trees lay flat and black against an aluminum sky, unmoving in the chill wind. An old man sitting at the foot of a grave mound, whose headstone had tilted slightly when the earth had settled, sitting in the rain and speaking to someone below. "They tore it down, Minna. I tell you, they must have bought off a councilman. Came in with bulldozers at 6 o'clock in the morning, and you know that's not legal. There's a municipal code. Supposed to hold off till at least 7 on weekdays, 8 on the weekend, but there they were at 6, even before 6. Barely light, for God's sakes. Thought they'd sneak in and do it before the neighborhood got wind of it and call the Landmarks Committee. Sneaks! Sneaks, Minna. They come on holidays, can you imagine? But I was out there waiting for them, and I told them, 'You can't do it. That's code number 91.03002, subsection E.' And they lied. And they said they had special permission. So I said to the big mucky muck in charge, 'Let me see your waiver permit.' And he said the code didn't apply in this case because it was supposed to be only for grading. And since they were demolishing and not grading, they could start whenever they felt like it. So I told him I'd call the police then, because it came under the heading of disturbing the peace. And he said, 'Well, I know you hate that kind of language, old girl. So I won't tell you what he said, but you can imagine.' So I called the police and I give them my name. And, of course, they didn't get there till almost 7:15. Which is what makes one think they bought off a councilman. Yeah, and by then, those dozers had leveled most of it. Doesn't take long, you know that. Well, goes on, and then nearby, yet at a distance, Billy Canetta stared down at another grave. He could see the old man over there off to his left, but he took no further notice. The wind whipped the vent of his trench coat. His collar was up, but rain trickled down his neck. This was a younger man, not yet 35. Unlike the old man, Billy Canetta neither cried nor spoke to memories of someone who had once listened. He might have been a geomancer, so silently did he stand, eyes toward the ground. One of these men was black, the other was white. And in the story, I never tell you which one is white, and I never tell you which one is black. I let you picture it any way you want. Of course, when we did the TV show, Danny Kaye was was the old man, and he was white. And it's a good story. It's about the hour that was lost when they went from my brain is having a fart at the moment. Blah 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 blah. Forget it. I know what I'm talking about.
All right.
When they went on to regular clock time.
You mean daylight savings time?
No. Back in the. I'm going to have to look it up here. You keep talking. Ask me another question. I'll see. I know exactly. The Roman Empire.
Oh, when they went to, you mean the Augustinian dating time?
Yes, yeah. From Augustinian time to whatever.
Right. Now, hearing that bit of that story, which has no magic or fantasy as you're reading it, I thought, well, that could be simply a piece of naturalistic fiction, like most of the world writes about the world as we observe it. That, though, has never been appealing to you. How come?
Well, what, you mean naturalistic fiction?
Yeah.
Well, but you just said it was naturalistic fiction. What I do is I take the mirror. I'm a very mimetic writer. I write things as they actually are. I reflect back. The human heart in conflict with itself, to quote from Faulkner, and I turn the mirror slightly askew so that something strange and wonderful happens. In fact, a little later in this story, only one page later, as two young toughs tried to beat up the old man, his name is Gaspar, and Billy Kinetic comes to his rescue. The old man has a pocket watch, and the pocket watch floats out of his hand. And that happens within the first minute in the TV show, because if you're doing this kind of story, you cannot have it backloaded the way, say, a Night Gallery, Rod Serling back, you know, Night Gallery was, where they would go through this whole long, boring story, and then in the last moment, the coffin pops up and Michael Enar jumps up. I put my magic in all the way through, and there is a flavor of, for want of a better word, magic. I don't think of it as magic. I just think of it as the unusual. But I think it is fascinating to talk about the way people behave and attach a fantastic element to it, the way all storytellers from Aesop on did it. That's all I'm doing.
Right.
I work in the common grain, as they say.
You seem, your imagination is, I don't know, seems manic. Your manner, you are so full of and fired up with ideas. Does that temperamentally suit you to write short fiction rather than longer novels? You've only written three long novels, and when you were a very young man.
I don't know. I look at what's being published today, and it certainly is not to the benefit of my exchequer writing short, because there are no markets left. Playboy, that used to buy stories all the time, now only buys excerpts from books that people think will sell, and Playboy is showing a financial loss this year, too. All of the magazines, Saturday Evening Post, Collier's, all of them are gone. And I wrote for the men's magazines for a long time because they were the only ones who were publishing fiction. Short stories do not keep you alive. Novels do. And the longer and windier they are, the more money they make you. And trilogies are even worse, and books with five to their number. And I think to myself, it only took Dostoevsky one book to do Crime and Punishment. Why do these blowhards, these bloviating nitwits, need six books to talk about dragons? So the readership has been bastardized as steadily as the movie-going readership viewership has been. And I write what interests me. And every story has a life of its own. It tells itself in its own good time. I like to tell a story about ordinary people to whom something unusual happens. And I suppose one of my best friends is Stephen King, and I love Steve's novels. But in essence, Steve's novels, many of them, are nothing more than a short story or a mid-length novelette pumped full of air. And the air that they're pumped full of are character studies. And he does it very, very well, and he gets away with it. And I adore and admire Steve and his writing. And my friend Dean Koontz does a lot of the same thing. But in truth, I am more fascinated about a story about a guy who insists on dragging a little old black lady with a shopping cart across the street, helping her across the street with her, cursing him and saying, "White boy, get your fucking hand off me. I don't want to cross the street." Why is he doing that? Why is she being bothered like that? And in fact, I started a story like that, and the next thing I knew, it was included in Best American Short Stories. It's called The Man Who Rowed Christopher Columbus Ashore.
Uh-huh.
Rowed as in a rowboat. And the peculiar interests me, the unusual interests me, and to sustain that for the length of a novel is not something that I find very interesting. But my rock novel, Spider Kiss, is a full novel, and, you know, I wrote a full-length autobiography with memos from Purgatory about when I was in jail.
It's funny, though.
I ran with the kid gangs in New York.
In Red Hook, near my neighborhood. It's funny, that in this age where people bemoan and worry that, oh, people's attention spans are so short, you think what you do, these vivid, stories about based on some peculiar premise done briefly would be all the thing. So that there's something kind of contradictory about that and the fact that you said the market has disappeared.
Well, you raise a hairy creature from the grave. It's very hard to explain, and short of having a 2-hour discussion about society today, I was asked to come and speak. I mean, I don't do college lectures anymore because I get so damn angry at them. They're so bloody stupid that I leave the stage and I go down and have to confront people. And I've gotten in fist fights with students. They are arrogant, slacker, pinheads. And I have no sympathy for them. They're all arrogant and they're all angry, but they have nothing to be angry at. They've got everything in the world they want. They've got an iPod connected to their penis, I presume. And I keep hoping.
I don't think that app has been perfected yet. But well, and we see some of that in the film about you.
Yeah, well, that's that. The film is a very accurate portrait of me, except Eric didn't catch me beating the crap out of anybody. But I just keep hoping that some Britney Spears wannabe is going to be walking down the street with her head plugged into music and get hit by a Seven Santini Brothers moving van. And I will chuckle and say, ah, good. This unpollutes the shallow end of the gene pool a little bit more. And people say, God, you're just an elitist. And I say, right on.
Let's listen to a little bit of Eric Nielsen's film, Dreams with Sharp Teeth. Let's listen to a little bit of Eric Nielsen's film about you, Dreams with Sharp Teeth. That is Harlan Ellison in Dreams with Sharp Teeth. Now, there you say, oh, you'd like to be angry. You'd like to be mellow. Have you ever tried to do anything about that?
Yeah, I'm mellow most of the time.
Well, no, you are. Even in the time we've talked, I can see that there are certainly...
There's a big... Look, first of all, the word rant has been co-opted by the imbecile internet. A rant used to mean one thing. A panegyric is another. A gardiloo is a third. I'm a passionate person. Yeah. I care about things. And I manage to express myself well. And I'm not like a flat affect idiot who can't speak. I ask someone a question. I go into a store and I say, do you have bedroom slippers? They go, what? I beg your pardon? They go, what? I say, what part of that question is arcane to you? I've always been impressed by W.C. Fields and the way he spoke with a certain rodomontade. I like using words. And so I will say to them, bedroom slippers, that is to say, young man or woman, slippers one would wear in the bedroom. Can you grasp the thought? Is that thought drawn in on the wind across that arid savanna between your ears? And they look at me as if I have fallen off the moon. But at least I have enjoyed myself.
Now, not to truck in stereotypes about Southern California, but... You live in Los Angeles, the capital.
Oh, get off my back, mother.
No,
don't give me that crap. I was in New York 6 weeks ago.
And there are a lot of idiots here as well?
Just as damn bloody stupid.
Yeah, I suppose. But not quite so much the will to mellowness. I mean, some of those, there are reasons that stereotypes exist. There's some truth to them, no?
There are stereotypes only because people like you spread them.
No.
There are just as many, yes. There are as many bright bus drivers as there are stupid bus drivers. There are as many bright secretaries as there are stupid secretaries. The expression dumb blonde comes from people telling dumb blonde jokes.
Yeah, but there are more people who prize mellowness above all things in Los Angeles than New York.
How do you know? You know everybody in L.A.? I don't know everybody in L.A.
Well, no, but I think we can agree. But evidently not.
No, apparently not. We have the largest population of immigrant Latinos anywhere in America.
Yeah.
Most of them very hardworking, yep. Very serious people. And they are not stupid and mellow. They work their asses off 24/7 just to put food on the table for their kids. The people who are mellow are the people that you show on TNT and Entertainment Tonight.
Yeah.
The world out here is not composed of nothing but Lindsay Lohan and K-Fed. I'm telling you. Trust me.
I live
in L.A.
I trust you. And you
don't trust me for a second.
Oh.
Why should you? I'm a liar.
I'm a what?
A liar.
A lawyer?
Not a lawyer. You
a liar.
Goofball, a liar.
No, I trust you. But I was just speaking to the fact that your passion and willingness to confront would I can imagine that it would seem weirder in more frequently in Los Angeles than it might say in New York.
Well,
City.
Take Billings, Montana. Okay.
Okay.
You would think Billings, Montana, people would just be so laid back and so cool. I mean, they live in Billings, Montana. A guy took a shot at me on the lecture platform in Billings, Montana, in full view of about 1,500 people. Took a shot at me. When the lights came up, no one moved and no one said a thing. It's because everybody in Billings, Montana is packing heat. Now you tell me, Billings, Montana is more laid back than L.A.? Come on.
Now your house, based on the pictures I've seen, from which you are speaking to me now,
yes,
looks like an amazing place. Can you describe it for our radio listeners?
Can I describe Ellis in Wonderland,
yes,
the lost Aztec Temple of Mars?
Yes.
No, let them go see the damn movie.
Oh, okay.
See, I don't want people to know where I live. I really don't. There are identifying marks on the house. And I hide in plain sight in this house.
Right, but it's an extraordinary, I mean, in terms of its decor and its themes and its extravagance and its Baroque quality, it's a one of a kind.
Well, I love Art Deco, and there's a lot of Art Deco here. I love Swedish furniture, so there's a lot of that, not IKEA, but real good Swedish stuff from back in the day. I've got 250,000 books in the house. My comic book collection is here. It's got secret rooms. It's got underground passages. It's got all the crap you wanted when you were 7 years old.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's the way I mark success, to achieve in adult terms that which you desired as a child. If you wanted to be a cowboy and you wind up owning a cattle ranch, you're a success. If you liked playing doctor and you wind up a brain surgeon, you're a success. I, in my own terms and by my own lights, I'm a terrific success, and I'm a happy guy. I'm angry at a lot of the world because they won't let us get food into Myanmar. I'm angry at the world because we've been lied to for 8 years by that pinhead George W. Bush. But, you know, I do what I can do. I do what I can do, and by raising my voice from time to time, it does some small good, and I think that's all one can hope for.
I would think that 7-year-old boy within you, with whom you have never lost touch in terms of your ambitions, would have loved computers and the internet, but not you.
No, I don't like the internet. I don't like it at all. Back in the day, as recently as 20 years ago, if you had an opinion, you were entitled to your informed opinion. Everybody says to me, I'm entitled to my opinion. I said, the hell you are. You're entitled to your informed opinion. An opinion without anything to back it up is just a fart in the wind. And with the internet, every moron who can put up some bullying, well, this new thing where they just arrested all these kids for bullying a girl into committing suicide.
Yeah.
I mean, that's unthinkable. In my time, that would be unthinkable. Bullies were considered only schoolyard menaces, and eventually you took a 2x4 and you flattened them, and they left you alone. Now, hiding out the anonymity of cowards, everybody has an opinion.
Right.
Everybody's a movie critic. Everybody's an art critic. Stupid little thing that happened to them in the course of a day,
yep,
mundane as it may be, they have to tell the world.
But I won't defend that whole part of the web, which, however, it seems to me somebody so omnivorously curious and interested as you would find the internet a gold mine, a place where you can...
Well, not so much.
No?
I have 250,000 books in the house, many of which are reference books.
Yeah.
Anything that I can't find in there or in the Encyclopedia Britannica,
uh-huh,
I can find out from some of the smart people I know. Occasionally, just like everyone else, I go on the internet. I am not a Luddite. I'm not an illiterate. I know how to use it. I know where to go. But as valuable as the internet may be for people like surgeons keeping up with the, yeah, cutting edge of medicine, or people who are looking for rare books across the seas,
right,
it's wonderful. But again, almost anything except a gun, which has no use other than to kill something, a knife. Can be used to kill someone, but it can also be used to cut your meat. It can be used to sharpen your pencil. The internet gives everybody a gun, and they can fire it any way they want. And trying to sort out the things that you need to know or the things you want to know from the dross can be a terribly time-consuming and ultimately unprofitable thing. Wikipedia can be changed by any moron who feels like going in, and they think this is freedom of speech. No, it's freedom of stupidity.
When you were that seven-year-old boy dreaming all your big seven-year-old dreams in in Painesville, Ohio, what other than being, as you've spoken about, being the only Jewish kid in town and being the subject of what sounds like perpetual anti-Semitic bullying, what were the influences that shaped you as a writer to be?
I'm going to give you the straight answer, kid, because you asked me truthfully, okay? When Time magazine came to interview me, I said, well, it was reading Mark Twain. It was reading Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. It was reading, and I named all of these good Tony writers, all of whom I have read.
Yeah.
But in truth, I was formed by pulp magazines on one side, The Shadow, The Spider, G8 and His Battle Aces, by comic books, Daredevil and Captain Marvel on the second wall. The third wall was old-time radio, just like in my story, Jeff D is Five, listening to Jack Armstrong. And on the fourth wall was movies. And I went to the movies every Saturday, and I saw serials, and I saw cartoons, and I saw all these wonderful, wonderful movies. I was formed by, I suppose, what is now called pop culture. And so when I grew up, it never seemed that there was any line of demarcation between high art and fine art and popular art as represented as low art. As a consequence, I was never at a loss. I was easily at home with Mark Twain as I was with Gene Colan and Batman.
So you were way ahead of the curve of the blurring of high and low that was supposed to have happened in the 1960s.
I like to think of myself as a healthy egalitarian, yes.
You mentioned Jeff D is Five, which is one of your great stories about this little kid, little boy who never ages over the decades.
Right.
I'd love you to read from that, if you wouldn't mind.
I happen to have it in a book of mine called Shatterday. And let me find it here. Here's a section after trying to explain this little boy, Jeff D, who... His friend grows up, and Jeff D and he, who were the same age when they were children, he's now an adult, sort of watching over Jeff D. And Jeff D has a radio that brings him radio programs from when they were children, Jack Armstrong, Captain Midnight, Tom Mix. And there is a section in the story in which I try to explain this. Hume denied the existence of an absolute space in which each thing has its place. Borges denies the existence of one single time in which all events are linked. Jeff D received radio programs from a place that could not, in logic, in the natural scheme of the space-time universe as conceived by Einstein, exist. But that wasn't all he received. He got mail-order premiums that no one was manufacturing. He read comic books that had been defunct for 3 decades. He saw movies with actors who had been dead for 20 years. He was the receiving terminal for endless joys and pleasures of the past that the world had dropped along the way. On its headlong suicidal flight toward new tomorrows, the world had raised its treasure house of simple happinesses, had poured concrete over its playgrounds, had abandoned its elfin stragglers, and all of it was being impossibly, miraculously shunted back into the present through Jeff D. Revivified, updated, the traditions maintained but contemporaneous, Jeff D was the unbidding Aladdin whose very nature formed the magic lampness of his reality. And he took me into his world with him because he trusted me.
That's Harlan Ellison reading from his short story, Jeff D is Five. It's interesting to me, as you were becoming the big deal that you are in the 1960s, that the kind of writing you do was suddenly acquiring cachet from Vonnegut to Borges to the science fiction writers of whom you don't include yourself. What was it about that moment that sort of allowed the world and the establishment to say, hey, this is pretty cool?
Well, yeah, you know, as Judge Judy would say, is not an answer. I'm hard pressed to be able to do that kind of semiotic analysis. I don't know. I suspect it was all in the lieu of Jack Kerouac and the Beat Generation and getting away from World War II and the middle class outlook in America, that staid, stodgy electronic hum of the Republican world. It was a time of upheaval. Emerging nations, the feminist movement, the civil rights movement, all of these things were beginning to happen in the 60s and 70s. It's easy for far right wingers of the O'Reilly Coulter breed to condemn those years and those decades as nothing but a bunch of idiot flower children streaking in the nude. But in truth, the seeds of everything of value, I think, that we managed to hold on to today in the face of an ongoing stupidification of America, are things that were brought to largeness in the 60s and 70s. And I hit right at that moment, and everybody gets their 15 minutes, and I've been very, very lucky. My 15 minutes has lasted since 1955, 56. And though somebody said, "You're not so famous." I said your name to one of my pals, and he said, "Who?" And then I said, "Britney Spears." He said, "Oh, yeah." And I said, "Oh, God." I said, if I sought the approbation of monkeys, I imagine I would be concerned about that. But anybody who needs to know my name will also know the name of Guy de Maupassant or Camille Babe Ruth or anybody else who did what they did on their own terms in their own lifetime and made a mark. There is too much emphasis put on the transient and the transitory. People who will talk around the water cooler about American Idol. I put cotton in my ears and go and read a book.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that I don't watch Lost every Thursday night, and it doesn't mean I don't watch Burn Notice on, I guess it's on USA, which is terrific. But I know the difference between shows where someone has put some thought in and, quote, reality programming, end quote, which is just another cheap way of saying let's not hire a writer.
It's your output seems not as incredible as it was. When I look at the stories you've published in the last decade or so, maybe one story a year. Do you write less or do you just publish less?
No, neither one. Jesus, kid, I'm 74 years old. It's like saying to a soldier who's been on the line for 12 years, go on back in and suck up them bullets.
Wondering.
What do I have to do? Do I have to write Moby Dick for you guys before you say, well, gee, you did a good job, lie down and go to sleep, old dog Trey? No, I'm still writing. You just don't see it. I mean, I'm not going to talk about, you know, your access to my work, but for instance, I have a new article in Skeptical Inquirer this month uh-huh. about Arthur C. Clarke. I have an essay coming up on writing about Octavia Estelle Butler, a writer I discovered, and that's going to be in a new book from Norton. I've had 25 things published this year already.
Amazing.
You just haven't seen them. I write every day. That's what I do. I don't write as fast, and I don't write as much. And occasionally I take time out to, you know, go to the bathroom and have a good meal with my wife or, you know, get some barbecue. But I still work.
At what time of day do you write?
Oh, I write whenever I feel like it.
Really? It's not like a ritual that you have to do?
No, God, no. Spare me from writers who write to a ritual. I got friends who, they get up at 10 o'clock, they write for 2 hours, they go for a long walk and lunch, and they do their calisthenics, then they go back and they write for another hour in the afternoon, and then they're free. I say, fine, you go to your church, I'll go to my lack of church, but we'll walk along together. No two writers work in the same way, and anybody trying to make a template for the way a creator should produce his or her work
mm-hmm.
is playing what Bogart called a mug's game.
Because it's not going to get you there. You either got the talent or you don't.
Yeah, it's who hears the music.
I have one last question for you. I think of you, as I was rereading your work and reading about you this last week,
what do you think?
Not
what do you
bad.
Think about me? Come on, be candid.
Not bad. No, it's amazing. I mean, the sense of a guy spinning off as many great ideas as you, is incredible. I mean, I only asked about, hey, how come you're not writing as much as you used to? Just because the expectations that you set for publishing, you know, a giant collection of short stories every like 10 minutes.
It was an average of one book of short stories
exactly.
Year and a half. I waited till I assembled new ones, and I've got enough assembled for a new book. I just haven't put it together yet, and we just made a deal with a major publisher to publish a book of my memoirs, which is where I was going a lot earlier when we were talking about
this. So you are going to do it.
So I'm finally doing this thing with great trepidation. It's called Working Without a Net, and what I'll probably do is just put down a lot of anecdotes and say this is what they are.
I've noticed lately, in the last few years especially, a kind of surge in apocalyptic thinking, and I wonder about it. And it's partly religious fanaticism and partly legitimate concern about global warming and terrorism, and maybe it's baby boomers seeing their own end and trying to extrapolate that. Do you think that this sense of the end...
It's cultural illiteracy.
Yeah?
Yeah,
you don't buy it?
So.
It's not the real deal?
We are one of the few nations in the world that is covered coast to coast with people who believe people walk on water, or that flying saucers land, or that you can talk to the dead. We are a fiercely anti-intellectual nation and always have been.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go out and ask people how many of them believe in God, you'll know you're going to get 90% of the people. And if you ask them how many of them believe in flying saucers, you'll also get the same 90%. They believe in everything but elves, gnomes, and leprechauns.
Yes, well, they believe in those too.
And there are some who believe in those too. I see that this rise in, as you call it, apocalyptic thinking is another manifestation of that. These end-of-the-worlders are forever saying, the world comes to an end next Tuesday, and then when Tuesday comes, it doesn't happen. They said, oh, we got it wrong, it's Thursday. And no one bothers to say, oh, gee, you're an idiot and you're a fraud. They still keep sending their money into the 700 Club just so that the 700 Club can keep going. It's just like a government. Their whole thing is to stay in power as long as they can. And I don't buy into that. I have my problems with the human race. I think that any species that can paint the Sistine Chapel ceiling and write Moby Dick and put a human being on the moon is capable of something better than McDonald's Toad Burgers and novels by, John Grisham and American Idol.
And you've talked a lot about the bad and the kind of unworthy things out in the culture. What's the last great new movie you saw?
Well, I'm not so sure it was actually great, but I saw one 2 days ago called Just Kill Me with Ben Kingsley. And I sat through it and had a wonderful time. It's about Ben Kingsley plays a hitman for an Irish family in Buffalo. And he's also an alcoholic, and his drinking is getting in the way of his doing his work properly. So they send him off to San Francisco to dry out and join AA. And he gets a job working in a mortuary, putting the makeup on corpses. And somebody says to him, well, aren't you, this is kind of icky. Doesn't this make you a little unsettled? He says, no, I have no problem with the dead. And I saw the movie only 2 days ago, and it was really well worth seeing. I'm a sucker for movies like Pirates of the Caribbean.
Uh-huh.
I think any movie... Look, among my favorite movies, kid... I keep calling you kid because anybody younger than 74 is a kid by me. How old are you?
53.
I got a sport jacket older than you, for Christ's sake.
So do I.
Do you really?
Yeah, my dad's.
Oh. I got mine the first year I was in college, 1954, at Robert Hall. It cost me $35, a Harris tweed. Beautiful. Anyhow, moving right along. My favorite movies are things like The Magnificent Seven, anything by Kurosawa. I will sit through endlessly. Or The Wizard of Oz, a friend of mine, Josh Olson, was nominated for the Academy Award for writing A History of Violence.
Uh-huh.
I loved that film.
Great
and then
film.
Josh and I became friends.
Great film.
There's good stuff.
Yeah.
There's a lot of good stuff, but there's so much stuff out there now. It used to be that you could winnow and pick, and you probably would catch up with everything worthwhile. And as Dickens said, any book one has not yet read is a brand new book. And I was able to read all the great stuff. I'm totally an autodidact. I'm self-taught, which I say thereby demonstrates the I'm a self-made man, thereby demonstrating the horrors of unskilled labor. But I was able to keep up with things, and I had a voracious need to know everything, which persists to this day. It's just that I'm finding it harder and harder every day to keep up with the things that are good, because there's so much stuff, and most of it is dross. Most of it is just chaff blowing in the wind. I can't keep track of every new group, and I don't want to. But I read the Week, the magazine, the Week, every week, and it's my Baedeker for the world. And anything that catches my interest there, I then go and search out. And people are always they go to my website. I have this website, harlanellison.com. And they'll pop in and they'll say, hey, have you seen such and such? And maybe 1 out of 10 times it'll be something I really am interested in. So I'm blessed, man. I really am blessed. I've got the best possible life. I have a sensational wife whom I'm nuts about. We're going into our 24th year. I got a great house. I live the life I want to live. I do the work I want to do. Nobody is my boss, which is the upside of being a freelancer. And if I have to worry about money, it's no worse than anybody else having to worry about money.
And I assume you don't much have to worry about money anymore.
Well, that's a misbelief. I am not a writer. Most writers are eking out an existence. Mm-hmm. Most writers are not in that top 2% of writers who make more than, say, $10,000 a year. Stephen King is up there. Grisham is up there. Danielle Steele is up there. And that's fine. They're very, very wealthy, and they're very, very good at what they do. Most writers, for God's sakes, eke out an existence selling paperback books for $5,000. Now, $5,000 does not go very far, particularly in these days.
But you're not in the eking out thing. And, you know, you've written so much over the years. Mustn't your library just be sort of spinning off revenue?
No. The thing about not being remembered is that who's going to buy the book by Harlan Ellison? You're interviewing Harlan Ellison, and you think I have some value, and I'm very grateful for that. But now people listening are saying, who is this guy? Who is this guy? Well, they'll go to the website, and they'll find Harlan Ellison. Gee, he's written all that stuff. Gee, am I interested in that? It's not as if they were going to see the new James Bond movie.
Right.
You eventually become either one for the ages and they give you the gold watch and happily plant you, or you keep writing and hoping that you can make ends meet. No, I don't eke out an existence, but I'm not fat.
And you're still spinning a lot of dishes on a lot of sticks, I guess.
Yeah, well, look, kiddo, last there's no reason I shouldn't be candid with you. What the hell? 3-4 weeks ago, my wife said, we've got no money. And I said, what does that mean? She said, well, we've borrowed everything out of my private savings. I have a corporation, and incorporating made it smarter for me to be a writer.
Uh-huh.
So the corporation, it pays all of our bills, and we handle it ourselves. We don't have business managers and lawyers and all that. Susan and I are the corporation, and we deal in, quote, literary services. I have an assistant mm-hmm. who works for me. And she works full-time for me. And the three of us are the whole shebang. And Susan said, we're broke. And I said, well, how much have we got in the bank? And she says, we've got $900. And I said, well, that's $900. She said, yeah, but that isn't going to pay the bills for the next 2 weeks. So I went out, and I made $32,000 in about 3 days. And this morning, I made $14,000. I'm a very smart... making money has never been a problem for me. I don't put any value on money. That's why it's no problem for me. I can make money all the time. How did I make $14,000 today? I went into one of the cabinets here in the house where I was collecting San Francisco rock posters from back in the 60s. And there were $50,000 worth of posters lying there. So we sent them to an auction house. They looked at them and they say, we'll advance you $14,000. I said, fine, send the $14,000. So the check came in today, and we're sitting fat. I'm not going to worry about money now for another 3 months.
Good for you. So something comes along.
Absolutely. My life is a long series of things that should have knocked me unconscious, which always redound to my benefit. Always. I make mistakes just like everybody else, but I live by Pasteur's adage, chance favors the prepared mind. As a consequence, I don't make as many stupid mistakes, and the mistakes I do make usually have an upside, good deal cutting edge to them, and I'm able to turn that to my benefit.
Harlan Ellison, I have entirely enjoyed this. Thank you very much.
You are a cutie pie, and I thank your mother for the chicken soup, and my wife and I clutch your antennae and enwrap your cilia with joy.
Yikes. Thanks.